The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. You hear it inside the Beltway. Weighted down by a stack of stuff. If you're watching on YouTube or on Rumble or on Salem News Channel, and I would recommend get the app, Salem News Channel, you will see that my stack of stuff is actually weighty this morning. I mean, it's ridiculous. Normally, I like a stack of stuff of between 14 and 16 stories. I can do that in two segments. It usually does the rundown in two segments. But there's so much going on, and I flew in yesterday from Ohio, and the Fetching Mrs. Hugh and I had dinner, and then I went to work for morning prep, and it's just too much. So I'm going to have to make this a three-segment rundown. And what's amazing to me, just genuinely amazing to me, is that Mike Gallagher comes in every single day. He got the sofa shift, right, from 9 to noon on the East, and then Dennis Prager has the second sofa shift. That's what they're known as in the business, the sofa shifts. From 9 to 3 East Coast time are sofa shifts. And so Mike gets off his sofa and goes over to the microphone and turns on the radio. He does it from his palatial residence. Well, he got five or six of them. And then he just talks to you about, you know, how his back hurts or his, you know, the cooking that he did last night or the show that he's been to if he's up in his New York. But, you know, some of us got to work. So here's the deal. Democrats are trying very desperately to get their massive spending plan done. It's down to $1.75 trillion to $2 trillion, which on top of the trillion in infrastructure is still so inflationary. Well, actually, I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm going to go to the lead right now. This is Lawrence Summers. Lawrence Summers was Mr. Economist for President Obama. He was Mr. Economist for Bill Clinton. He's Mr. Economist at Harvard. He's Mr. Economist. He's a Democrat. He's a liberal. He went on CNBC with David Westin yesterday, cut number 14.
David, we have transient inflation. Annual inflation in last month, according to core CPI, was above 10%. Majority of that is surely transient. We've got used car prices. We've got other examples that people cite that are clearly transient. But it is an elementary fallacy to confuse the idea that we have some transient inflation with the false proposition that all the inflation is transient and we have nothing to be concerned about. If you look at things that are longer lasting, labor shortages, pervasive. If you look at things like the largest component of the cost of living index, housing is on fire. As your listeners know, a majority of houses are selling above their asking prices. In many parts of the country, housing inflation has been close to 20%, the vast majority of which has not yet shown up in any index. And so if you look at what purchasing managers are saying, if you look at what households are expecting, all of this suggests that we're in the process of seeing a change. And the people who are big on this transient idea need to ask themselves, do they really believe that 10% growth, which we're going to have this quarter, 10% growth, which people think we're going to have next quarter, dramatic declines in unemployment or growth in labor shortage, either way, that we're going to have all that, and that's going to be part of a process that drives inflation down? I don't think so.
So what Larry Summers is doing, again, former president of Harvard, I had dinner with Larry Summers once at Regents College when we were both part of a program at Regents, great program, fascinating conversation. He's a little bit unusual, and he fixes on one person, in this case me, and he converses with you for the entire dinner. Larry Summers is widely regarded as brilliant, and with good reason.
So what he's telling you is inflation is here to stay. And as the sun goes up on that idea, Democrats are rushing to finish their spending plans for political purposes. And the New York Times says Biden and Democrats push for budget deal this week as rift remains. Well, what's the rift over? How much to spend and what to spend it on and where to get it from? Second New York Times story by Neil Orwin. Proposed tax on billionaires raises question. What's income? They are proposing the biggest shift in American taxation policy, because what begins with billionaires will soon move down to 100 millionaires, then it will move down to 10 millionaires, then it will move down to millionaires, and everyone with a house will get caught by it. So they're trying to just put into place a tax framework that they can jiggle the number on in future years, but it's a highly complex thing. And billionaires, of course, aren't sitting around saying, go ahead and take my money. They're flooding town with their lobbyists to fight this. In town, I mean the Beltway, and we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, Democrats, according to the Washington Post, quietly scrambled to include immigration provision in social spending bill. Democrats are scrambling intensely behind the scene to address immigration in the framework as they are crafting to expand the nation's social safety net, according to people with knowledge of the situation, writes Sean Sullivan and Mariana Sotomayor, who is in the Washington Post this morning. Even as President Biden and other party leaders have said little publicly about their strategy in recent weeks, the most pressing question confronting Democrats is what to do about millions of undocumented immigrants seeking a path to legalization. One option under discussion is to provide a protected status that stops short of a path to citizenship. Another, which is seen by some of the people with knowledge of the situation as something of a placeholder, is to include a proposal that would enable immigrants who arrive in the United States before 2010 to apply for a green card. The talks, described with people of knowledge of the situation, some of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to disclose sensitive discussions, are said to remain fluid, with no final resolution yet. The problem is, and I have tweeted this out, the Senate's parliamentarian says the registry idea, which is being floated as a workaround from their earlier Senate parliamentarian's refusal to discuss amnesty in a reconciliation package, is not acceptable in a reconciliation package. So they're trying to jam in an amnesty on the QT. Meanwhile, another Post story this morning, John Hudson and Ellen Nakashima, in advance of climate summit, tension among Biden aides on China policy. And so you have to, the Post has now taken to pushing the lead way down. But the problem is John Kerry wants big climate gains, and he wants diplomacy with China, and neither China nor Biden want to talk to each other because they're on the brink of a very, very big confrontation in the South China Sea. And so I'm telling you right now, that's not going to get done. They're going to go off to Glasgow, and they're going to have everyone show up in Glasgow, 200 different countries, 160 countries, COP26 or something, who knows what it stands for. And they're not going to get anything done because China's not going to do anything. And the United States Senate and House won't agree on anything that will make it into reconciliation that even is passable as a pretend costume, a Halloween costume of climate change legislation. Meanwhile, across the river, with all eyes in D.C., trained on across the river in Virginia, they see Glenn Youngkin's numbers. And private polling shows him surging, harnessing, according to Politico, parent anger in a possible 22 GOP preview. Look, this has got nothing to do with 22 GOP preview. This has got to do with Virginia being in a total state of disarray under Democrat Ralph Northam and Terry McAuliffe before him. Terry McAuliffe is trying to make a comeback. Glenn Youngkin is betting on parents' anger with local school boards to help him edge out a victory in Virginia's governor's race against Terry McAuliffe. It's so bad, Terry McAuliffe is now getting calls from people saying, Terry, I'm going to be late to the party next Tuesday night. They really don't want to stand around in the ballroom like Al Gore's ballroom in 2004. They don't want to be in the Romney ballroom of 2012. It's where everyone thinks they're going to win, and then they know they're not going to win. You don't want to go to those parties. They're starting to call McAuliffe and say, I don't think I want to get close to you. Do you know why? Because of stories like this one. Loudoun County forces parents to sign a non-disclosure agreement form to view the CRT-inspired curriculum that is called the Second Step, that is going to focus on the LCPS. Loudoun County School Board wants people to sign terms and conditions to display license that the Second Step curriculum, which has been singled out by the Loudoun County Parents Against Critical Theory PAC as the source of the problem. They don't want to show you why the diversity, equity, and inclusion curriculum put forward by the anti-racist organization inspired by Imran Kendi They don't want to show it to parents. They want to sign parents to an NDA. Don't sign the NDA, parents. Use the Virginia Freedom of Information Act. But there's a reason Glenn Youngkin is surging. People have had it with bureaucrats, whether they're education bureaucrats, state bureaucrats, or federal bureaucrats. They've had it with bureaucrats, and it's less than a year into the Biden administration. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Come right back.
Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com.
Welcome back, America. That music means Drucker is in the house. David M. Drucker on Twitter with the Washington Examiner, author of In Trump's Shadow, which we had a great conversation about last week. I've seen Drucker all over the place talking about In Trump's Shadow. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Hugh.
How goes the book sales? Are you exhausted by talking and talking and talking about In Trump's Shadow?
Well, I'm not, but only because I'm enjoying it. And, you know, before I was a journalist, I was in sales and marketing. And if you don't sell a good product, and then it's not going to sell. I think it's a good product. I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. You were very generous with your time. And so I've enjoyed having people react to the book, ask me questions about the book, and talking about it.
In Trump's Shadow, available at bookstores everywhere and also at Amazon.com. It informed my question matrix for the debate on Sunday night in Ohio, where six would-be Republicans are seeking the nomination for the seat of the retiring Rob Portman. And it's amazing how much In Trump's Shadow influenced my understanding of what was going on. Five of the candidates were quite certainly trying to be like Trump on immigration, on voting rights, on election security. One of them, Matt Dolan, was very much trying to be like Rob Portman. That's Trump's shadow, and it goes beyond the presidential race, David Drucker. It goes down to every race.
It does. And if you want to have a good understanding of how 2024 could look, in addition to reading In Trump's Shadow, which is my shameless plug for the morning, you can watch the Senate primaries unfold in Arizona, in North Carolina, in Georgia, in Ohio, where you just were. Because almost every candidate, and there are going to be some exceptions like a Matt Dolan, but almost every candidate is going to be competing to prove to voters that they are the heir to Trump's legacy. I mean, this is how he has impacted the party. And I don't know for a fact that nobody's going to invoke Ronald Reagan's name, and his name deserves to be invoked. But I think we've seen a generational shift. That was one of my biggest takeaways from In Trump's Shadow. Now, some of these Republicans, and you'll see this in House races and Senate races as the campaigns unfold into 2022. You'll see this in 24. Some of them will say, I'm going to give you the best of Trump without the worst of Trump. But some of them are going to say, I'm going to give you the best of Trump with the best of Trump because there was no worst of Trump. And it'll be interesting to see how Republican primary voters react to these candidates, particularly if they don't have Trump himself in 24 as a choice. In other words, are they going to, by and large, say the Trump agenda was amazing, so many things he did was amazing, but we could do without the attitude in terms of the self-inflicted wounds? Or are they going to say, nope, that's exactly what we want, and whoever can give us that in its totality is who we're voting for?
David, when I considered the Glenn Youngkin campaign, Glenn Youngkin has proudly said he has combined everyone from the forever Trumpers to the never Trumpers. That is the winning formula. And you have to do it in such a way as the independents don't even think Trump is being discussed. And I look at that race and I think Terry McAuliffe is getting a lot of voicemails saying, Terry, sorry, we're not going to be able to make it on Tuesday night. It looks like a wake over there right now. He could still pull it out. I suppose Joe Biden's going across the river today And I suppose anything is possible with turnout. But boy, are parents angry over Virginia schools, and not just CRT. The quarantine rules aren't driving people nuts.
Yeah, look, I have to say, because Virginia has over time become so reliably Democratic, I don't think you can rule anything out. And even Republicans who are optimistic think this thing's going to be really close. But I think where Terry McAuliffe made a mistake is without Trump in the White House, the fact that he's an ex-president, I think made the attempts to paint Glenn Youngkin as a Trump foot soldier ineffective. And I think he did not focus enough on the issues that voters care about. A lot of times this stuff is way overcomplicated. Sometimes you're on the wrong side of an issue because of what you believe or because of timing. But, you know, Terry McAuliffe had a chance, had he done so, to say, look, you know, I've been gone for 4 years, and I realize, you know, what has happened while I've been gone and while I applaud my successor. We need to make changes. And he could have focused on this just as much as Glenn Youngkin did, and recognized the problem they had in the suburbs. I don't know if they took suburban votes for Democrats for granted because of how the Trump era was, but I think there was just a miscalculation there. And even if they weren't going to focus on education, I thought issues and issue-based attacks, unless the personal attacks are present themselves in such a way that you just can't pass them up, I thought would have been much better than trying to paint Glenn Youngkin as Trump, because it doesn't answer to voters, you know, how are you going to fix my problem?
It doesn't. And I'll tell you, last night's Politico reporting, the McAuliffe campaign near panic and a pivot to education. If you're pivoting with a week to go and there are reports of panic in your campaign, David, what do you say? What do you think?
Well, you're in deep trouble. Look, I think it was a week or 10 days ago when Terry McAuliffe ran a television ad trying to debunk the attack on him from the comment at the debate. And I have to say, you know, on the one hand, if you take the totality of McAuliffe's remarks in that debate, he wasn't necessarily saying what suburban parents thought he was saying. But the problem is that's what they thought. The timing was horrible. Glenn Youngkin was able to use it to his advantage, and that's how campaigns go.
And that's how they are won. David M. Drucker, author of In Trump's Shadow. Get you to Ohio if you have a two-book contract, because that Ohio Senate race is really a book in itself. It really is. Don't go anywhere, America. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show straight ahead. I still haven't gotten through the rundown. I'll do it in the next hour. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway this morning with Senator Joni Ernst of the great state of Iowa. Good morning, Senator Ernst. How are you?
They had you on with you.
Thank you. I want to begin by asking you about the headlines this morning that Democrats are attempting to write both a billionaire's tax language and an amnesty proposal into legislation that you haven't seen, I assume.
No.
What could go wrong, Senator?
Oh, heavens, what could go wrong? Absolutely everything could go wrong. And we have been discussing some of these proposals that the Democrats are coming up with. And of course, you are absolutely correct. We haven't seen anything in writing, which is very typical around this place. But what they're proposing is, you know, the billionaires could be taxed on what's called unrealized capital gains on their liquid assets, meaning, you know, wealthy billionaires, they would be taxed on things like stocks or other assets like real estate, where they actually haven't seen any money yet. It's unrealized. Well, how do you do that? And what happens if you lose money in your stock portfolio? Does the government give you money back? It's a crazy scheme. And I guess we'll just have to have IRS agents living with billionaires so they can figure all this stuff out.
What I'm most worried about, Senator, is they shoot for billionaires and they hit millionaires. And by that, I mean there are people who own a lot of land, especially in your state, who are farmers, who are land rich and income poor. I also
cash
understand
poor.
That there are some cash poor. Mm-hmm. There are some people who are going to be built on income,
which is a terrible way to tax people on income, because income doesn't mean anything unless you know how much the expense ratio is. But mostly, I can't believe trying to rewrite the American tax code in secret. They need the wisdom of the crowd here. They need a lot of people to look at this. And you're a senator. You haven't seen it yet?
No, of course not, Hugh. Don't be silly. Yeah, this is important, and I hope people understand this, as so many bills that are being proposed right now add substantial cost to the American taxpayer and radical change from the way we do business across the United States is all being done in secret. It's not going through the typical committee process, subcommittee process. It's not being presented in written form so that people can scrutinize it, provide input. What they're doing is negotiating behind closed doors. We see that going on down at the White House and with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And again, this is a radical shift from the way we do business here in the United States. And it's not just the cost of the proposals they're putting forward, but it is the changes in policy which lead to socialism with a radical expansion of welfare programs.
And I also see the attempt by Senator Durbin, your neighbor to the east, to try and write in an immigration amnesty. And Senator Cotton has been warning about this. I never really thought it was true, but it's reported today. They're trying to, even though the parliamentarian has told both sides of the aisle, you can't do this in reconciliation. They're not giving up, and you can't see it, so you can't raise an alarm.
No, and again, all the negotiation in secret, and policy is not supposed to be wrapped up in this. It does have to be related to the budget. However, we see they're desperately trying to tie various pieces of immigration legislation into this bill. Now, we'll have to see what the text is, but we do believe it won't fit into reconciliation, but that doesn't stop the Democrats. So they're going to try to pull whatever they can into this massive tax and spend bill and again, radically change the way we do business across the United States.
What I really think is crazy, Senator, I love your comment on this, is that they say they are rushing to a deadline imposed by Joe Biden before he leaves to Glasgow, Scotland for the climate summit. Think about that. He's going to get on Air Force One and fly 4 hours. And that is a deadline to go to a summit at which he will barely participate in, which no binding commitments will emerge. And we need to write the tax code in response. It doesn't make any sense. It's an artificial deadline to try and get your colleague Joe Manchin to shut up and sit down and try and get your colleague Kyrsten Sinema to shut up and sit down. It's artificial.
It is artificial. And we see this time and time again where they set deadlines that have absolutely no meaning. And they rush through different pieces of legislation. So we see this once again with an artificial deadline of the end of this week. So here we are. We haven't seen any legislation. We're waiting on the House to act. And, you know, meanwhile, we're working on low-level nominees in the administration here in the Senate doing the confirmation process and voting on these nominees on the floor when we have other really important pieces of legislation that need to get done, like our National Defense Authorization Act. That should be on the floor right now. We should be debating that, doing amendments to it, going through the regular process, and yet they keep putting that off. That is one of the singular things that the federal government should be doing right now.
I also appreciate your efforts to keep a spotlight on the 363 American citizens and legal permanent residents abandoned in Afghanistan. You've met with John Andrzejczyk. You're talking about Afghan veterans. I really appreciate that effort, Senator. Now I want to ask you about Facebook. There is a new Wall Street Journal story this morning about Facebook attempt to hire a prominent Democratic lobbyist. That's the headline. Mm-hmm. Facebook encounters challenge and bid to hire a prominent Democratic lobbyist. And they're going to pay this individual $2.5 million. And they're supposed to help Facebook out of their problems in D.C. And they've mentioned Valerie Jarrett and other people. Nobody wants this job. I can understand why. What is a you're a senator. I mean, they're shooting at you, a supermajority senator. What do you want in a lobbyist to be a good lobbyist? Because I know Mark a little bit. I've had dinner with him a couple of times. And I wouldn't presume to tell him who to hire, but I know that if you hire Valerie Jarrett, don't even expect anyone to talk to her.
Right. I think what they should be doing is finding somebody that is absolutely nonpartisan, somebody that walks that line of finding solutions and not gunning for the other party, trying to squeak by assisting one party or the other. Facebook is in some real trouble right now, and they have a lot of questions directed at them that they have not been able to answer. And so this is a tough situation that they are in. And again, it needs to be somebody absolutely nonpartisan. You know, they have struggled with answering why they only target conservative thought on their platform, not questioning thoughts coming from the other side. I think they need to relook who they're hiring and at what cost.
And now I also believe they're getting hammered by the left for not doing enough to prevent the transmission of damaging information from both sides. They're in a pickle, and that's an old saying, but it's true. They're in a pickle.
They are in a pickle, and if you also go out and scrutinize not just what's going on here in the United States, but what they have allowed to happen in other countries with the promotion of religious hatred, there is so much wrong with Facebook right now. They have dug a hole. They need to throw out the shovel.
So let me talk to you about the kind of people you enjoy talking to and your staff enjoys talking to. I'm not a lobbyist. And those times that I've been involved in trying to talk to members of Congress, they usually talk to me because I don't ask for anything for myself. And I'm curious, what do you welcome into your office? Who do you like to engage with on matters of policy that is lobbying? And that lobbying goes on every day. It's fine. People want to have their views understood. Facebook wants their view to be understood. But who do you as a senator like to see in your office?
Well, it's number one, it's always Iowans, and they're regular people. And that's, I think, what a lot of folks fail to understand is, you know, we welcome folks into our offices, and Iowans come out nearly every day. I have a group of Iowans in my office, and they are lobbying me on different issues. And this is the brilliant thing, and what I love is that we have regular people whose lives have been impacted by policy decisions. So they understand those policies, and they understand how to make those policies better. So they come in, they're always very well informed, they've studied the issue, they know the pros and cons, and they're able to present that to me. And so I think, you know, in a situation like Facebook, they need to hear from real people. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle they're on, they need to hear from real people and have people that will reflect the overall views of the United States.
That sounds like a 50-state strategy, to find voices from both sides of the aisle in all 50 states and have them work. Is that what works?
That would work.
Okay, good. Thank you, Senator. I'll talk to you soon. Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That music means Admiral James Stavridis is in the house. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. How you doing?
I'm terrific. Washington Post this morning, 5 a.m., Dan Lamothe. In Taiwan war game, few good options for U.S. to deter China. The Center for a New American Strategy ran a war game involving the Dongshu Island. I'm probably mispronouncing that. Didn't go well. It didn't go well. And in fact, they're even worried about bigger scenarios than that. I'm not surprised. Are you surprised, Admiral?
No, I'm not. I've participated in several of those war games over the years. U.S. Indo-Pacific Command runs those on a regular basis. And they're increasingly reflecting the reality that China has many more ships, much more capability in their aircraft, longer land-based ballistic and tactical missiles. That's been on the upswing for a decade and more, and it's starting to really bleed into the results of these war games in a negative way.
In the end, the article says the best advice is that warn the Chinese ahead of time of the consequences they would face if they moved on any of the islands, including Taiwan, with Japan playing a significant role.
Haven't we already done that? Didn't President Biden sort of accidentally do that in the town hall last week where he said we would defend Taiwan?
Well, he certainly said that we would defend Taiwan and we have a commitment to do so. But then within 24 hours, you saw both the White House spokesperson, Jen Psaki, and the Pentagon and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin kind of return to this former policy. It's called strategic ambiguity of not telling China exactly what we're going to do. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. My own view is that, A, we should, in fact, assist Taiwan aggressively if they are attacked. And B, it's time to tell China that we are going to do that. And I think there's a growing sense of that in the public conversation about this.
I think they may have overplayed many hands, Admiral. I want to talk to you specifically about Enes Kanter, the Boston Celtics center. Now, I'm no Celtics fan, but I'm applauding Center Kanter, who called out Nike, LeBron James, and General Secretary Xi in a three-minute audio, which I played earlier, video audio, which I played the audio of earlier. And, of course, the NBA is trembling. What do you advise the NBA, or what would you advise the NBA to do when they've got players who are out there doing the right thing, demanding human rights for Uyghurs and the end of forced labor, but a vast market that's about to close to them?
The NBA has got to stand behind free speech in the end. They're an American entity. They are responsible to stand for American values, and therefore the NBA cannot be put in a position of disciplining its players for speaking their mind.
Okay, that is what I agree. I think they've got to just step back and say nothing. And if China takes them off the air, General Secretary Xi will simply deprive his people of basketball. And that's his problem. Now, Admiral, let me talk to you about Facebook. Facebook has international problems of the sort, as chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, you survey every single day. And as an admiral of the ocean-going sea, you used to serve for years and years and years about. They are trying to hire someone to persuade both sides of Congress. Senator Ernst just said, hire a nonpartisan person. When you were at the Pentagon, either staff secretary or executive secretary to Donald Rumsfeld, or when you were running Southern Command or NATO, who would you listen to from the defense community that was in the lobby? Would you listen to big names from the Republican or Democratic side, or would you look for experts?
We always looked for experts, and I think that's true as a general proposition. We want not only an apolitical military, but we want a group of advisors who are not tied specifically to domestic politics. You want to hear from people who have spent their lives thinking about the international world, and they exist on both sides of the spectrum. Look at someone like your friend and someone I know, Robert O'Brien, former national security advisor in the Trump administration before him. H.R. McMaster served in that role, obviously a military background. But on the Democratic side, look at someone like Kirk Campbell, who is in the White House today, overall in charge of Asia policy. He is smart, switched on. He's a Democrat, but he is all about thinking about the international side of the house. So you need experts who are deeply read in their area. And the penultimate example would be Henry Kissinger, for example, who are just so deep into the issues and ideas, they kind of transcend the politics. That's who you want advising you.
Well, my last example would be you, since you gave penultimate example being Kissinger. But I'm curious about military men and women when they come out. Do any of them go into lobbying? I know many of them go to work for defense firms, but that's a little bit different than what I'm talking about. Do any of them go into the lobbying business?
No, I don't. I imagine you could scare up an example or two, Hugh, but the senior military I know, when they retire, they're willing to serve on corporate boards, for example, and give internal advice to corporations. They're certainly willing to do commentary in a public way, like I'm doing right now, sharing their expertise and ideas. They're willing to take on leadership roles, running everything from universities to businesses that have nothing to do with defense. And yes, they go to work for defense companies, but in those roles, they're doing leadership, internal advising, geopolitics. I'm unaware of any senior military who functions as a lobbyist.
You see, I think that's unfortunate because if they were selective about their clients, they could be very powerful advocates because of their expertise. I am curious if you think a military person would fit well in the super Facebook senior vice president level that they're looking for in D.C. Because Facebook's got international issues. I mean, they've got revolution that they're cooking up in Kashmir. I've never been to Kashmir. Have you been to Kashmir, Admiral?
I have flown over parts of Kashmir.
Okay, you're closer than I'm ever going to get. And so the Facebook controversy is that they are fueling Kashmiri terrorism and Kashmiri resistance and Indian violence and anti. They need someone with a worldview, right?
I think that's fine, but that, I draw a distinction there between that and, if you will, classic lobbying, where the word comes from, hanging out in the lobby of a senator or a congressperson. I think this is more about giving advice, giving public commentary. I could see a senior military in that role being quite effective, yes.
Yeah, that's what I believe, is that Joni Ernst said, I don't want anyone who's identified with politics. You said, I don't want anyone who's identified with politics. Well, the only way to do that is to find the apolitical branch, which is the military. Now, I am a little bit alarmed. I just moderated a debate in Ohio where a number of the candidates took shots at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley. And my friend, as you mentioned, Ambassador O'Brien, tells me he's a wonderful man. He's done great service and is a warrior. I've read his record. How did that happen? How did this happen that we've begun to take shots at our senior military leadership? That has never happened, in my knowledge, in the United States before.
It's another reflection of the extreme polarization of the country. And those shots are, frankly, coming from both sides of the aisle, not just against Mark Milley, who I know extremely well. He worked for me on several occasions and is absolutely a stand-up officer. What we need to do here is take a step back from this kind of vitriol that flows on both sides and recognize that someone like Mark Milley has a tough job working across party lines in the current moment and a tough job staying in the same job under two very different presidents. I think he's handled it reasonably well with some very difficult scenarios that he's had to deal with. But when you see people going after someone like that, it makes you worry. And frankly, Hugh, as we both know, it's part of the debate, unfortunately, about COVID today. Here we have a life-saving vaccine that's widely available, completely free, and yet a lot of people are choosing not to take it because they're getting misinformation. And that's really unfortunate. It's another example of polarization and politics bleeding into areas they shouldn't get into.
Let me talk to you about that in close there, Admiral. The New York Times today reports that the FDA advisory panels were afraid of issuing complicated advice because they would further confuse the public, indicating an underlying problem as to the public certainty about the efficacy of CDC and FDA guidance. They have somehow, over a year and a half of this virus, crushed CDC and FDA credibility. And I don't think I would have ever imagined that the CDC would lose America's trust, but it has. What do you do? I mean, it's just a given. I like Tony Fauci. I like Francis Collins. They've been guests on this show. I respect both of them. Great souled men. But there is obviously a disconnect between public health and the public. How do you build the bridge again? What do you do?
Well, one place to start would be where our conversation was a moment ago, which is the social networks. And it's not just Facebook. It's Facebook, Twitter, Google search algorithms, the way people jump onto Instagram, TikTok. All of these are massive influencers of the public. And we don't want to get out and deeply regulate them, but we do want to establish guardrails about patent untruths that are flying around in those circuits. That's a pretty good place to start. Number two is, we need our elected leaders to stand behind people of quality who are in apolitical roles, Mark Milley, Anthony Fauci, and not allow them to become political footballs. So I think it's, as usual, it's leadership and in the social networks and sides. It's also technology that can help you. And these are difficult, big conversations for the nation, but we have lost our way here in both the instances we've talked about. We need to get our way back to the center.
I would add, once it's broken, you've got to recognize that it's broken and find new people. And I don't this is an increasingly complicated situation. And I really don't know how a search committee for credibility goes about its business. But the American public needs that, right? That's the bottom line.
That's absolutely right. And so a fundamental point to be made here, by the way, Hugh, is all the people we've talked about are servants of the nation. And if you're someone who has labored hard for relatively little amounts of money and you've worked through your life doing that, that ought to be celebrated more, not criticized. And I think that's an important function here, is celebrating those who have served the nation, not just in uniform. There are a lot of ways to serve this country.
I agree with that. And it's always good to talk to you, Admiral, as you have served this country for so many years. Appreciate the conversation. Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former head of Southern Command, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Mark Zuckerberg had to throw $100 million at him. I would hire Admiral Stavridis to fix his problem because he might be the only person left. I really don't know who's left. I mean, I cover many Democrats, trust me, and most Republicans, but I don't know who actually gets 75% of the country to listen to them anymore. I don't know that such a person exists as they're looking for. They may have to go with the 50-state strategy. In any event, bad situation for there. Meanwhile, Dwayne is in the news. A man fraudulently received COVID relief funds. Then he spent $57,000 on a Pokemon card. Now, there's no name in here, but Dwayne, do you do Pokemon? Never mind. I got to do ReliefFactor.com. ReliefFactor.com. I took it this morning in the first hour. I remind you in hours 2 and 3. My neck feels a lot better this morning than it did yesterday. Not 100% back yet. Hotel pillows, the bane on anyone who spends as much time crouched over a screen as I do. You just can't sleep on them. But ReliefFactor.com helps you get your way back. They are the natural anti-inflammatories. Now that I'm reading Ras Douthat's book, In the Deep Places. His new book is called The Deep Places. It's about chronic pain. He suffered from Lyme disease, and we'll talk with him about it tomorrow. The Deep Places is about what do you do with pain. One thing is you try everything. So if you're a chronic pain sufferer, just try ReliefFactor.com for 3 weeks, $19.95. It doesn't work, that's fine. But maybe it will. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Tuesday morning. Joined again, finally, by Robert Costa, back in his radio wheelhouse after authoring Peril with Bob Woodward. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
Hugh, it is great to be back with you.
Well, thank you. You've had a long book leave. You had a great bestseller. Peril is in bookstores everywhere. It continues to sell. It continues to make news. In fact, let's go back to the most recent headlines, Robert Costa, from Peril. What is the latest? It's really the John Eastman memo. And John's a friend of mine, and I've known him forever. He's a very fine lawyer. You put in the short form of the Eastman memo. Did you have the long form available to you?
Well, there are two versions of the Eastman memo. The Eastman memo that matters in our report in Peril is the one that goes to Senator Mike Lee of Utah that was circulated by the White House on January 2nd, 2021.
Did Eastman know it was going to go out from the White House? Because lawyers will often, I haven't talked to John yet, but they will often prepare talking point memos, summary memos that are not supposed to go A, to the client, or B, to the top of the client chain, and certainly not outside of the client's control.
Well, I'm not sure what Eastman knew about the circulation of his memo. I do know that John was in the Oval Office with Trump and Pence and Mark Short and Pence's advisors on January 4th, 2 days before the certification, pushing the argument. Eastman has made further comments about that meeting to the New York Times in our book, which is We Stand By. Trump was really telling Pence, listen to John. You can do this. You can walk away. Try to allow this to go to the House, delay the certification.
And so John Eastman has said that his longer memo makes clear that he did not favor this. And I'll talk to John sometime about this. But let me ask you about the impact of Peril. It certainly is going to make it less likely that lawyers will give their candid set of option advice on the far flung to the near certain legal options to a president. Don't you think that's going to happen?
I think, Hugh, though, you got to have, if when you read the memo, the memo says there are alternate electors in the states, and that just wasn't the case. And so that it was Eastman's memo says there's going to be a scenario where alternate slates of electors are available. Now, Eastman has publicly made the case that he wanted to delay the certification if Pence went in that direction. He's making the recommendation that alternate slates would somehow appear, but they weren't. No state legislature had recognized any alternate slate at that time on January 4th, 5th, or 6th.
No, I think it was completely far-fetched. I do not believe it was an option. I would tell John that. I don't think he ought to have put that in paper because I know how the president thinks, which is give him an option that's far out there and he'll seize upon it as though it's mainstream and viable. And assuming it's sort of like, how does an economist get out of a hole in the ground? First, you assume a ladder. Here they assumed an elector, and you can't. I mean, you just can't do that and give it to Donald Trump, or he's going to assume the elector.
Exactly. I mean, I can't read John's mind or Trump's mind, but Trump wholesale bought in. I spent 9-10 months digging into this. Trump was wholesale believing that this election could go to the House and he could win, and that alternate slates of electors could somehow be brought quickly to the fore that would allow him to have a victory in the House. This is something he truly believed.
I agree, Robert. What I try and tell everyone is that the President Trump is first and foremost a real estate developer, and real estate developers see houses and buildings and malls. They don't see empty ground. They don't see zoning restrictions. They don't see state law. They don't see CEQA and NEPA and endangered species. They don't see anything except their vision. And if you tell them at one time it's possible we could get 5 units an acre, they'll want 6. I mean, that's just how developers think. That's why they get stuff done. It's also why they go bankrupt and then get things done. And it's Donald Trump. And if you give him a memo that says, maybe if electors show up from one state, we'll be able to have the vice president put that aside, he's going to will it into existence. Is that your experience with the president?
Well, I've had interviews with him, but I do know that the story we've reported is that Trump really believed at the end that this was a viable option. And someone like Mike Lee, and I think the Lee component's important. We report that Lee himself, you know, is a serious lawyer on the right, is trying to look at this and says, this just isn't possible. This is not. And that's why we also detail in the book how Senator Ted Cruz, he's telling Trump at the end on January 5th, look, we're going to object to Arizona. We're going to propose a commission to look into these issues. But even at that moment, Trump's saying to Cruz, based on our reporting, hey, you got to do more. You got to object to every state. There was an expectation that many Republicans found unreasonable that Trump, they wanted to help Trump. Lee likes Trump. Cruz likes Trump. Eastman likes Trump. But there was an expectation by Trump at the end that these things could really move forward in a way that didn't seem legally or politically possible to a lot of people around the president.
Yeah, I'm reminded of P.J. O'Rourke. You don't give whiskey and the car keys to a teenage boy. You don't give scenarios on the Electoral College to a president who's facing defeat when those scenarios simply cannot happen. Let me turn now to the consequences of Donald Trump's continued interest in the 2024 election. I moderated a Senate debate in Ohio among GOP candidates on Sunday night. 6 candidates, all with 7-figure budgets and rising, Robert Koster. These are all deeply well-financed candidates. 5 of whom are clearly trying to grab the former president's attention, one of whom, Matt Dolan, is running as Rob Portman. Do you think that's going to be replayed in every race in the United States in 2022?
It's certainly possible. I think if Virginia turns toward Youngkin, and I think the Youngkin model could become something you see in a lot of states that Republican candidates are going to go, hey, we may not want to be totally with Trump, but we can't walk away from Trump. And there's going to be a competition for how you navigate that in a primary. I don't think it's going to be Marjorie Taylor Greene in every single primary winning that type of a true through and through Trump style Republican. But you're not going to be a never Trumper, I would expect, and win a lot of Republican primaries should the tide continue to move in that Trump direction.
Matt Dolan is not a never-Trumper. The interesting thing is the fusion of both with Glenn Youngkin. Glenn Youngkin, his public, said, I've got the forever-Trumpers and the never-Trumpers both supporting me over education.
And I think that's the model. And the latest Monmouth poll is it's tied. I actually think McAuliffe is losing and Youngkin is winning. And this morning, the idea, well, Terry McAuliffe yesterday told WRC Channel 6, WTVR Channel 6, this, cut number 5.
But, you know, this is Youngkin trying to stir up this critical race theory, which I'll be honest with you, Bill, I find highly offensive. Critical race theory is not taught in Virginia. It has never been taught. It is a racist dog whistle. And I'm really tired of it.
Now, the Daily Caller this morning, Robert Costa, reports that Loudoun County forces parents to sign an NDA-style form to view the CRT-inspired curriculum. There clearly is CRT and its legacy in some school boards. Terry McAuliffe keeps dismissing people as racist who ask about it. Is that a winning strategy?
Well, I mean, there's a lot you just laid out there. When something is labeled CRT-inspired, what does that mean? I got to read that story. I'm not tracking Loudoun County as closely as I should be, though I know Loudoun County seems to be in the national news every day. Look, Terry McAuliffe, I live in Northern Virginia. You know Northern Virginia well, Hugh. There are government workers here. It's very vote-rich. It's very moderate to liberal, you know, with a lot of the voters in Arlington and Alexandria. He needs terrific turnout, and he needs black voters in the rest of the state, in some of the more rural areas, to come out. I'm not so sure. I don't – anecdotally in Northern Virginia, I still think this is a very Democratic area, so I'm not writing McAuliffe off at all. But you can see the Republican voters, especially swing voters on education, are certainly animated.
Yeah, my anecdotal reporting is moms. Moms who are facing quarantine rules for children who are largely unaffected by, even when they get the COVID virus, that get kids out of school for 24 education days. And Robert, that just doesn't fly with moms. I mean, they are up in arms. I think they're mixing up the CRT angst, which is true. This story, by the way, is about, it's well documented, the Second Step programs from a branch of the left-leaning nonprofit organization Committee for Children, which has been obtained by the Daily Caller. Go look at it. But there's not just CRT. It's also the COVID, the shutdown, just a lot of angst over everything. And I think Bob McDonald won fairly handily, didn't he, 8 years ago?
I covered that race. I covered McDonald closely in 2009. And I just remember when there's a Democratic president, it's hard for a Democratic gubernatorial candidate to win in Virginia. And it's something that's almost kind of a fundamental political reality. An incumbent first-term president of one party doesn't help someone running in the same party.
In Virginia. I think that is absolutely a bellwether call. Robert Costa, good to talk to you again. Go get Peril. It's in bookstores everywhere. He and Bob Woodward did their investigation of the end of the Trump presidency. I'll be right back. America, it's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
I've been meaning to burn you, but from Minnesota. And it's been a very long time. You wear it well. A little old-fashioned, but that's all.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. He's a little old-fashioned, but he wears it well. How are you, Senator?
I'm very well, Hugh. I hope you're well, too.
I'm great. I'm just back from Ohio. I'm going to talk to you about that in a second. But first, I have to say, you were right, and I was wrong. The Washington Post this morning has a headline, Democrats quietly scrambled to include immigration provision in social spending bill. I assume that after the Senate parliamentarian told them they could not do that, they would stop trying to do that. And you said, no, they're up to no good. You're right. They're trying to put an amnesty into the reconciliation bill.
Yeah, Hugh, the Democrats will never stop trying to put amnesty in any legislation to include a taxing and spending measure where it obviously doesn't belong because they are 100% committed giving amnesty to illegal immigrants who have come here in violation of our laws and an affront to all those immigrants who waited in line and did the right thing and immigrated legally into our country. The latest gambit, I think, is Senator Durbin, who never fails to put foreigners first and Americans last, trying to change the date in which illegal immigrants can get a green card, which, of course, is a pathway to citizenship. I think the current law has it somewhere around the early 70s, which obviously excludes almost everyone. And they want to update that to say 2010. So
yes.
Anybody who's been here since before 2010 will be able to get a green card. Again, in a taxing and spending bill. Now, this has no place in that legislation. It's a plain violation of the Senate budgetary rules. I'm sure you can cook up some way in which it would have a budgetary impact, probably because of all the new welfare checks you'd be sending out. But still, under the Senate rules, it is what they call merely incidental to the policy impact. And this is plainly a massive policy change to implement the Democrats' open borders and amnesty agenda.
Now, on a certain professional level, I have to say, nicely played to Senator Durbin. The idea of changing a date and thereby rewriting the immigration law to, in effect, loophole in the Reagan-era amnesty to the current date. That's kind of brilliant, Senator Cotton. Just one date. Who would have noticed?
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes, Hugh, immigration law is like that. It's a highly complex technical area of law in which changing one number or one date or one clause creates massive real-world consequences. But again, Hugh, just think about how unpopular the Democrats' argument is. They want to shoehorn a massive amnesty into a budgetary measure. So they have to argue that it has a budgetary impact. And why does it have that budgetary impact? Because you're going to make millions of illegal immigrants eligible for welfare checks and food stamps and heating assistance and public housing assistance at a time when many Americans are struggling to make ends meet. So the Democrats have to go out and contend that not only are we going to give amnesty to illegals, we're going to do so because it's going to make us spend a lot more on welfare payments. I don't think that's going to win many votes next fall. It's probably not going to win many votes in Virginia next week if the people in the Commonwealth of Virginia get wind of it.
You know, Glenn Youngkin is now described as being in a dead heat. And it all depends on turnout. That's legacy speak for Youngkin is ahead and Terry McAuliffe is going down. We have to CYA. And I think it's pretty, I don't know if you've been out on the trail with Glenn Youngkin. He's got crowds wherever he goes. His bus tour is a great success. He's surging.
Yeah, I've done a couple events with Glenn Youngkin, who I think is a very good man and a fine candidate and will make a great governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. One of the venerable offices in our country, you know, held by great statesmen like Thomas Jefferson and James Monroe. I do think that Glenn is going to win next week in Virginia, in part because Terry McAuliffe is not just a washed up, crooked swamp creature, but because he has a radical agenda. You know, he said publicly on television that he does not think parents should have a role in their kids' education. He's standing behind school boards who are sweeping underneath the rug rapes of young girls because it interferes with their transgendered agenda. To say nothing of Glenn's plans to actually help working families make ends meet during the Biden inflation by, say, eliminating the grocery tax that Virginia still shockingly has, unlike most states, and by making it harder to raise property taxes on working class homes.
That washed up, crooked swamp creature line is really effective. But I kind of like Terry because he taped this ad for me once. Can you play it, Adam?
I'm Terry McAuliffe, and you should listen to the Hugh Hewitt Show every single day, the greatest radio show in the United States of America.
Now, I think you probably agree with that, Senator Cotton. So I've got to thank Terry, even as I point out, Glenn Youngkin's going to crush him because of schools. I have family, and they are outraged over the quarantine rules in Virginia school. They have no idea what they've done to the suburban mom.
And Hugh, you know, there's the statement that parents shouldn't be involved in schools. There's the quarantine rules and the masking rules, which are obviously not necessary if you look what's happening in other states, or you look for that matter what's happening in schools across Europe. There's the elimination of classes and programs they have at great and venerable public schools like Thomas Jefferson, one of the finest public schools in America, which is also one of the toughest public schools to get into in America because they have selected admissions where you have to take a test and have a GPA standard and meet those. And why did they do that? It was because the administrators and bureaucrats in those schools thought there were too many Asian kids going to those schools. So Democrats, Virginia has civilization grants that want your kid in our school that's student like you. The exact kind of policies that we started in this country years ago. But that's what Democrats have reverted to in many places across Virginia and across the country.
Yeah, keeping Asian American kids out of merit-based schools is a winning formula for nobody, and Democrats have embraced it. Senator Cotton, I want to go back to immigration because in Ohio on Sunday night,
Josh Mandel said, I'm against amnesty. I want the wall. I stipulated that. And I don't want any more legal immigrants in the United States who are eligible for welfare benefits until every homeless veteran is housed. They're housing illegal immigrants in motels by the border, to which Bernie Moreno, the charismatic businessman from Cleveland, who is himself a legal immigrant, said, you know, Josh, you're wrong. They're busing the illegal immigrants all over the country, flying them to different places all over the country. Is that correct, Senator Cotton?
Well, I didn't see the debate, Hugh. I do have it recorded because, of course, I never miss any appearance of Hugh Hewitt.
I think that's important. Yeah.
But, yeah, they are transporting illegal migrants all across the country. You saw the stories, I think, about a week ago of airplanes landing in the dead of night in places like Florida and New York State. And, you know, it's funny that they're doing this in the dead of night, suggesting that they don't want people to know about it when they keep trumpeting their immigration policy as humane and humanitarian in contrast to former presidents. But they're also busing them across the country. You know, I've been to the border. I fly through Dallas and Houston airports regularly to get home to Arkansas. And it's a very common sight to see people holding manila folders, and written on the outside of that folder is, I'm a migrant who doesn't speak English. Please help me find my flight. And then the flight number is written in on it. You know, that's what our government is doing for these migrants and to communities. They really have no say in whether or not they're going to be inundated with busloads or plane loads full of illegal migrants who have no means of supporting themselves, who don't speak our language, who are going to put a tax on their hospitals and schools and housing and other public services.
That's what Bernie Moreno was arguing. I will come back to that. Let me go back to something. You were in the forefront of killing off the attempt by the reconciliation bill to do away with stepped up basis, because Arkansas farmers and foresters and people across the country were deeply concerned with this. Now it turns out that Ron Wyden and his team are drafting some kind of a law about unrealized capital gains, allegedly only for billionaires. And they say only 800 people will draft it. Well, putting aside the merits of the argument, and I don't think they're very good of ever to tax unrealized capital gains, what is your level of confidence in their effective legislating so that unintended targets aren't hit by this?
I have zero confidence in the Democrats' ability to draft a highly complex, novel tax on the fly just to satisfy their desires for $3.5 trillion of reckless news. You know, to make it concrete, Hugh, for your audience, an unrealized gain is when you say buy a stock in January at $100, you hold it through the end of the year when it's selling at $150. Now the government's going to say, oh, you have $50 in gain. You have to give us 14 of those dollars as a tax, even though you don't have the cash. Of course, people who are very rich often shift out of assets or taxed, shift in assets who aren't taxed. So you could expect to see billionaires buying up private islands and horses and jewelry and paintings. I guess if they're going to be buying paintings, that's probably good for Hunter Biden, though. So there's one upside for Ron Wyden's new tax. But Hugh, this is just really the camel's nose under the tent. They're not going after 700 billionaires in America. They can tax them all they want. In the end, it's not enough to satiate their desire for more taxes to spend on more welfare. They want to get this tax written into law so in the future they can start dropping it down further and further and further and further until they get to what they view as the golden goose, which is your 401k plan.
In the end, this is so smart. This is exactly
good enough for billionaires. It's good enough for your 401k, and they're going to start taxing your 401k each year, make you pay those taxes on what you're putting aside for retirement.
Unrealized capital gains is the same for everyone. That they say it's a limited by income, it will go the same way as the income tax went. Started with a little income tax on the wealthiest people, it's now on everybody's back. If unrealized capital gains are taxed, it will expand to everyone, not billionaires. It is the camel's nose. Only I don't think they're even going to be able to write the law, Senator, because it requires competence to write a law like this, and they won't show anybody. When do you get to see a draft? Last question.
Yeah, and here, I mean, it's a good one good sign of that is that the Democratic chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, who's been writing tax laws for 30 years in Congress, he opposed it in part because it's a highly complex effort to write an entirely new kind of tax into the law. And the Democrats are doing it in secret, on the fly, while they're trying to juggle another $4 trillion of spending, solely because they want that spending. So even if they do get it passed, One, it's probably going to have massive unintended consequences for our economy and for jobs. But two, it's probably going to be struck down as unconstitutional as well. This is the kind of taxing power that is reserved to the states in our system of government. And the federal government has never had the power to impose this kind of tax.
Senator Tom Cotton, on that note, thank you. You were right. I was wrong. I should never underestimate the perfidy of legislative efforts by Democrats. I won't do it again. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, thank you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.